Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Peterson Toscano of Citizens Climate Radio is our guest host today for Spirit in Action. He's been working very hard since I saw and interviewed him 6 weeks ago at the FGC National Quaker Gathering, which you'll understand better if you listen to that interview with Peterson via NorthernSpiritRadio.org. But he's back today to share some more riches. He has selected stories from his show designed to inspire you to think about our world in fresh new ways. While his focus is on climate change, you will find that his guests and their techniques have a broad application to different social change efforts and world healing. It takes time and effort and deep commitment to bring together folks like Rob Hopkins, Kerry Ziegler, with Peterson and his co-workers of Citizens Climate Radio, like Erica Valdez and Horace Moe, to move us forward towards a saner and safer world. And that's why we're incredibly thankful that they bring the top-notch guests, ideas, and talents of Citizens Climate Radio here to share with my Spirit in Action listeners by guest hosting this show every 3 months. I'll let Peterson take over now to flesh out today's Spirit in Action show by Citizens Climate Radio.
In the Nerd Corner, Dana Nucitelli answers a very important question. Is a carbon price still the most effective policy in a post-Inflation Reduction Act world? Kerry Ziegler joins us to share an extraordinary community art project that resulted in the passage of meaningful legislation. She engaged hundreds of school children to use plastic bags to send a big message to lawmakers. Kerry demonstrates how art and artists can help us convince the public and policymakers to make the right choices. But first, I want to immerse us in a world of imagination. Some may think that playful imagination is a helpful escape from real-world problems. My guest begs to differ. He sees our imaginations as the essential tool for addressing these problems. My first guest is a time-traveling do-gooder in England. No, it's not Doctor Who.
So I'm Rob Hopkins. I am the founder of the Transition Movement. My work is about finding positive solutions to climate change. And in my spare time, I do printmaking. So it's normally easier just to say I'm an author and an activist, really. It saves a bit of time.
The Transition Town Movement is a community-led initiative that aims to promote self-sufficiency and reduce the impact of peak oil, climate change, and economic instability. It encourages communities to take control of their own future by adopting sustainable practices that are kinder to the environment. Rob and his colleagues have successfully implemented innovative approaches to change the way certain towns operate. I recommend you watch the documentary Transition 2.0. You'll learn about inspiring stories of communities working together for self-sufficiency and sustainability. It features innovative ideas like printing local money, growing food locally, and setting up community power stations. But I didn't invite Rob Hopkins to our show to discuss the transition movement. Instead, I requested him to share the tools, techniques, and strategies he uses to think outside the box. And this includes time travel.
And so in the time machine, I always say to people to close their eyes and imagine that we're going to travel to 2030. And I have different techniques that I use to do it and make it quite theatrical, you know. And then I say, well, the 2030 we're traveling to isn't a utopia. It's not a dystopia either. But it's the result of us having spent those years between now and then doing everything we could possibly have done. And I always remind people, 9-10 years is actually a long, long time in terms of things can happen. It took 10 years from Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat on the bus to the Civil Rights Act being passed in America, 10 years from the first international sanctions on South Africa to the new constitution being created in South Africa, 10 years from the first iPhone to half the people in the world having a smartphone. Maybe that's not quite such a good one, but you know, things change really, really fast. So I ask people to close their eyes and to imagine that they're moving through time and that then they're being dropped into that 2030, and then just to take a walk around using all their senses. What does that world smell like, feel like, taste like? And I've done that exercise now with thousands of people, and I've done it with 10 people in a workshop. I've done it with 1,500 people in a hall in Belgium. And what's so fascinating to me about that activity is that no one ever says, we've got a new IKEA. It's 4 times bigger than the one we had in 2022. No one ever says, my iPhone 28 can give me real tattoos or something. You know, it's like, actually, everybody says the air smells cleaner, the bird song is louder, there are less cars, people seem more content, they spend more time with their family, they don't work so much, their work is more meaningful, and so on and so on. You know, it's universal. So then I always think, well, why do we not start there and work backwards? We start with, how are we going to achieve that? What would that look like? And that's why in the podcast that I do, every episode starts with us doing some time travel. So if we're talking about universal basic income, we don't debate whether it's a good idea or not. We say, we've had a universal basic income now for 8 years. How does the world taste differently? How does it sound differently? For me, there's something about helping people to create a new North Star in their life. Like, I want that.
Rob Hopkins' podcast is called From What Is to What If, and it's named after his 2020 book about unleashing the power of imagination to create the future we want.
I feel like there are some people like me who can read terrifying, depressing climate papers and somehow translate that, transmute that into doing something. For a lot of people, they just get really stuck and really paralyzed. And I think if all of our narrative is just about extinction and collapse, we don't offer anything. You know, the poet Rilke said something like, the future must enter into you a long time before it happens. Just so beautiful. You know, and if we don't allow the future to enter into people, if we don't cultivate and nurture in people the most profound longing for a low carbon future, if the way we talk about a low-carbon future doesn't make it sound delicious and irresistible and abundant and gorgeous, then why is anyone going to want to do that? We're only going to go there if it feels like we're moving towards something irresistible rather than being dragged away from something irreplaceable. And so how do we do that? So for me, I use that idea of time travel in lots of different ways.
Rob has often said, climate change is the greatest failure of the imagination in the history of humanity.
The big challenge that we have is that there are so many people in the positions of power who should be reimagining everything. I mean, you know, just to put it in context, you know, the United Nations said staying below 1.5 degrees was beyond us unless we were to see the rapid transformation of societies. That's what they called it. So loads of people, all the headlines are saying, well, 1.5 degrees is beyond us now. Maybe that's the wrong way of looking at it. Maybe the question is, how do we create a rapid transformation of societies? If that's our only option, it's like death or rapid transformation of societies. I think we should put a bit more effort into that rapid transformation of societies bit myself, you know, thinking outside the box here. Mariame Kaba, who's a great hero of mine, amazing prison abolition activist in the US, she said, we live in a system that has been locked into a false sense of inevitability. Which I love it. So many of the people who are holding on to those positions just can't imagine anything else. The people in the Department of Transport can't imagine a future without cars. The people in the Department of Energy can't imagine a future without fossil fuels.
I am not at all surprised that important business and government leaders do not reach the point where they can imagine big systemic changes. They take themselves very seriously. And so much creativity and fresh ideas come through cultivating a playful attitude.
When I do workshops and trainings with people, a lot of it is about play and just getting people to play again. And so whenever I do workshops, even with the most serious, uptight of people, who often come with lots of baggage around being right and not wanting to make a fool of themselves and not wanting to take any risks and having to get everything right, is I put them into groups of 5 or 6 people. I give them a potato each, and I give them a bunch of cocktail sticks. And I say, you can go outside, you can add anything to this that you want, but I want you back here in 25 minutes with a creature, and I want to know its name, I want to know its mating call, and I want to know what its diet is. And they just go off, and you watch them go, and they just giggle for about 25. You just hear them go around, go, and the beautiful thing about it is you can't make anything out of potatoes that isn't ridiculous. Even if you are the most perfectionist engineer, you can't make something out of potatoes that doesn't look really stupid. And it's a really nice way of just getting people freed up a bit. When I do public talks as well, they become more and more like workshops, and we do an exercise called Yes and Yes But, which is what you learn in improv, you know, the difference between yes but and yes and, which is really important, because all of us as activists, our experience is that everything we encounter is yes but there's no money for that, there's no whatever, there's no time, we tried that before, it didn't work, all that kind of stuff. When I'm designing a 2-day workshop I'm going to be running in Belgium in a couple of weeks, and we spend half of the first day in the forest using a set of exercises which allow adults to see the world, to see the forest like they saw it when they were a child. That kind of shift in our thinking is really, really powerful too. So in terms of an exercise, there's something that was developed by Transition Network working with Encounters Arts, who are an amazing community arts organization, and it's called Transition Town Anywhere. So the idea is you get about between 200 and 400 people. You need a big space. You start with doing some time traveling, of stepping into the future that we could still create. And then you think, well, what am I doing in that future? What's my role? What's my job? What's my work? Then you meet other people who are thinking along the same lines. You design a project together, something you're doing. Maybe you're running the bank. Maybe you're running the energy company. Maybe you're a whatever. But then you literally build it with cardboard boxes and bamboo and sticky tape and string and pens. You create this three-dimensional version of that future that you then live in and inhabit and play in. And it's one of the most magical, magical things I've ever been part of. I think we need to find a lot more things like that. Our activism needs to feel a lot more like play.
Rob reminds us that speaking about climate change is significant climate work. How we speak about it, though, can make all the difference.
It's really important that we have the conversations with everybody we know about the climate change and the situation that we're in. You know, when people say, well, why do you do this? It's like, it's one thing to say, because I'm terrified about the future and climate change. But maybe we could flip that and say, because I am so, so longing for a world where the bird song is louder than the traffic. I'm so longing for a world where the rivers in our cities are so clean that people can swim to work. As the world grew warmer, we realized that the tarmac was killing people, the concrete was killing people, and so we took up 80% of it, and now our cities are full of wildflowers and plants. And I so long for a world where when you go to visit the theater, they've covered the outside of that building with bird boxes and insect hotels, so when you approach the theater, it's more alive with wildlife than visiting a jungle or something. Give people that longing. Cultivating longing is the most important thing, I think, that we can be doing as activists. And we can't do that without artists, storytellers, musicians, poets, film writers, novelists. We need everybody, because we have to bring this alive. There's a beautiful quote by Arundhati Roy. She says, "What lies ahead? Reimagining the world. Only that."
That was Rob Hopkins, host of the podcast From What Is to What If. Learn more about him, his book, and the Transition Town movement at his website, robhopkins.net. And while you are there, definitely check out his newest projects, The Ministry of Imagination Manifesto and Field Recordings from the Future. Coming up, Dana Nucitelli will answer the question, is a carbon price still the most effective policy in a post-Inflation Reduction Act world? Carrie Ziegler, an artist on the west coast of the USA, tells us about a community art project that changed a law. And I have a good news story about a successful campaign that got a lot of people talking about climate change. Stay tuned. When we want elected officials to change policy, we have many ways to reach them and build political will. We write letters to the editor and op-ed pieces. We start petitions. We send messages to our lawmakers and even show up at their offices to compel them to vote for an environmental and climate-friendly policy. We need to be heard above all the other voices. But without a big public relations budget, what can we do? That's when we can turn to our friendly neighborhood artists.
My name is Carrie Ziegler. I am a collaborative artist living here in Olympia, Washington. And what I love to do more than just about anything else is to work with hundreds, sometimes thousands of individuals with schools, nonprofits, local government, to create these multifaceted, large-scale, collaborative art and action projects around different environmental and social justice issues with the goal of inspiring positive change in our world. I went on a journey, you know, through a life journey for many years trying to figure out how to bring art and science together. Like, I did that in so many different ways. I worked as a naturalist and environmental educator for a long time, so I've worked with people a lot, and I would often bring art into that work. It took a long time for me to figure out what collaborative art was for me. That really came together about 10 years ago when I was working for my county, Thurston County, as an environmental educator. I had this opportunity to create some programming for youth, and my supervisor was very open-ended about it. During the time, we were going through a process in our county to decide whether or not the public was ready to, wanted to ban single-use plastic bags. And since I was really passionate about that idea, I wanted to end the use of single-use plastic bags, I decided to do a project around that. As I started thinking about it, as often happens for me, my ideas, they just kind of grow and get bigger. And so I thought, hey, why not create a life-sized plastic whale out of plastic bags and other trash? Amazingly, my supervisor said, okay, go for it. You don't got any money. We're not giving you a budget for this, but you can go and do this wild idea. What I ended up doing was working with over 900 kids and adults in classrooms, in community spaces, teaching them about marine biology, about the impacts that plastic bags have on our environment, and talking about solutions to that. And then together with all these different people, we created this whale, this life-sized gray whale out of plastic bags and other trash. And so each individual who was part of that project got to do a piece of this work. Younger kids, elementary school age kids, they would bring their plastic bags in from home. We all used to have this giant bag full of plastic bags just stuffed under our counter, right? Or in the closet or somewhere. And so they would bring in these bags full of bags and we would pull them out and create this mountain of plastic trash in the middle of their classroom or the school gymnasium. And we use that to help us understand how many plastic bags were being used every single day in our school, in the city, you know, throughout the world. It was really, really powerful. They cut and braided plastic bags, but they loved it. I must have taught like 500 kids how to braid that winter. Some of them got so into it, they wouldn't stop. They would have these long braids spread all the way across gymnasium floors. It was really incredible. So the whale was modeled after an actual whale that had washed up on shore in Seattle the previous year. And that whale, when the scientists did the necropsy, they found, amongst other things, they found a bunch of plastic bags in its stomach. That's why we chose the gray whale. The whale itself was 32 feet long, so about the size of a juvenile gray whale. This project was so impactful because the students and the people who worked on it, they only got to see the beginning of it. But then I made sure that the whale, when it was all completed, was in a very public place. We unveiled the whale, if you will, at our annual Procession of the Species celebration. It was in this parade of sorts where thousands upon thousands of people got to see it. And then it was on display in the Washington Center for the Performing Arts, and everyone was invited to come and see it. People got to see the impact of it. But the thing that's really important about this project is that that whale helps to shift public opinion in my county. There were actually council members who invited me to bring the whale to their city council meetings as a way to talk to their constituents about the importance of like reducing the use of plastic bags. And in part because of that project, all four of our local jurisdictions did implement a ban on plastic bags. That was incredibly powerful. But you know what was more powerful than that? There were kids, particularly middle school kids, who talked about how they felt personally responsible for that ban on plastic bags. That's one of the things that collaborative art is so important for. Like, it's so powerful because it gives people an opportunity to create something way larger than they ever could on their own, to be a part of something that is so much bigger and to take ownership over it. Like, those kids felt like they changed our government, and they did. When I think about collaborative art, I think about how it opens hearts, how it breaks down barriers, how it creates an opportunity for the people involved to have a story to tell about something that they are passionate about that can help them to connect with others and create change.
And that was Carrie Ziegler, an artist, activist, and so much more. Learn about her other projects, read her journal, and see videos at her website. That website is carrieziegler.com. Ziegler is spelled Z-I-E-G-L-E-R. Also, see our show notes for images of the Whale Project. Visit cclusa.org/radio. Now it is time for the Nerd Corner, hosted by Dana Nucitelli, Citizen Climate's Research Coordinator.
Hi, I'm Dana Nucitelli, CCL Research Coordinator, and this is the Nerd Corner. I'm here to highlight some interesting new climate research for the nerds out there and to make it understandable for the nerd curious. In this episode, we consider the question, is a carbon price still the best climate policy in a post-Inflation Reduction Act world? Research has long shown that putting a price on carbon pollution, in combination with some other complementary climate policies, would cut emissions enough to meet America's Paris commitments. That's what studies were finding 10 years ago and 5 years ago, but what about today? Time keeps marching relentlessly forward, and in 2022, America passed its largest ever climate bill in the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA. Ever since then, we nerds have been waiting for some researchers to evaluate how effective a carbon price and other climate policies would be in today's post-IRA 2024 world. And we finally got our wish. The Hamilton Project and Brookings Institution brought together some top-notch economists to look at 7 different scenarios. Those scenarios centered mainly around 4 big climate policies. First, they looked at repealing or keeping the EPA's various climate regulations. Second, they considered expanding or keeping or repealing the IRA. Third, they simulated implementing a clean electricity standard which would require electrical utilities to get a certain percentage of their electricity from clean sources by a certain date. And fourth, they looked at what would happen if we put a modest price on carbon pollution. Expanding the IRA didn't have much of an effect on climate pollution because the existing law is already investing a lot of money in clean technologies. The clean electricity standard didn't fare much better because it would only affect the power sector, but the clean energy tax credits in the IRA are already working to quickly decarbonize our electricity. But putting a price on carbon pollution would impact almost every sector of the economy, and so it had the biggest and most cost-effective impact on emissions. It turns out that a carbon price is still the single best climate policy. Overall, the study found that adding a modest carbon price on top of the IRA and the EPA regulations would nearly meet America's Paris commitment. It's fair to say that also adding clean energy permitting reform to maximize the IRA's potential and/or implementing a more ambitious carbon price like that in CCL's favorite bill, the Energy Innovation Act, would meet our goal of cutting America's climate pollution in half by 2030. We know what to do. Now we just have to go out and make it happen. I'm Dana Nucitelli with the Nerd Corner. Thank you for being curious and for your commitment to climate progress. To join the discussion about climate science, technology, economics, and policy with CCL's research team, check out the Nerd Corner at cclusa.org/nerd-corner. That's cclusa.org/nerd-corner. I hope to see you there.
I'm sure you're all vastly enriched by all these gifts from Peterson Toscano and Citizens Climate Radio. We'll have links to all of this on northernspiritradio.org in the same place where we have info and links for all of our Spirit in Action and Song of the Soul guests of the past 19 years. Such riches. So please post a comment, let us know you're out there listening, and let us know which guests, topics, and programs you especially like. Let's be friends. So make it two-way by posting on northernspiritradio.org. While there, check out the 35-plus community radio stations carrying our shows all around the USA. And if your local community radio station is not on the list and doesn't carry our shows yet, maybe you'll feel led to have yourself and a dozen of your friends lobby for them adding us to their schedule. They can get it for free from us, and maybe all they need to know is that there are local listeners who want it. In any case, please support your local community radio station, but I also ask that you support us, because we can't go on without your support. We still need a couple $1,000s just to make it through to the end of this year. But enough about Northern Spirit Radio. Let's head back to our guest hosts, Peterson Toscano and the other fine folks of Citizens Climate Radio, with some important examples of storytelling.
Today, we are going to explore personal stories as metaphors. These stories have energy behind them because they're meaningful to us, but they're not explicitly climate change stories. Instead, they could reveal a truth or a perspective that we can relate to some aspect of our climate change work. You will hear three different stories. Two of these come from CCR team members Erica Valdez and Horace Moe. I gave them each the following assignment. Share a meaningful story from your life and experience, but do not write specifically about climate change, the environment, or nature. Consider moments of transitions in your life, conflicts, or breakthroughs. Include specific details about people, places, things, and settings. Express your emotions and share your feelings in different parts of the story. The assignment is essential for helping us craft compelling stories that capture and retain the listener's attention. Erica and Horace both recently graduated from college, and they chose stories from their time as high school students. They wrote their first drafts and shared them with me, and I gave them lots of feedback. In both cases, they needed to add more details about the people in the story. They also needed to add emotion. Their stories had endings, but these needed to be strengthened. Storytelling is a craft. It requires humility and patience so that we are able to receive feedback. A first draft may be good, but it must be much better. My husband is a professional writer and teaches creative writing at a university. Even as an award-winning author, he recognizes that his first draft is incomplete. He shares his writing with me and with his writing friends. He listens to our feedback. He makes changes and works on it to make it better and better. This work is crucial, and your hard work will be rewarded. First, let's hear Horace's story. Horace added music and sound effects to make it pop. But listen for the details he includes and the emotions he references. Also, be aware of the feelings his story stirs up for you.
A 16-year-old boy carried two black 50-pound suitcases alone and flew across the Pacific Ocean from China to the USA. It was the boy's first overseas trip, and he landed in an all-boys boarding school in Salzburg, Pennsylvania. While the boy was excited about the new educational opportunities awaiting him, he was concerned about assimilating into a completely unfamiliar living environment. Even worse, he could barely speak fluent English at that point and was ill-informed about American culture. That boy was me. While facing the uncertainty and being far from home as a teenager, I was fortunate to meet my first-year roommate Kai, a black 16-year-old from San Francisco who is devoted to soccer and always possesses contagious and joyful giggles. I didn't know it then, but Kai would become one of my best lifetime friends. The first several months of school were tough for me. I had a hard time fully comprehending class lessons due to my limits in English. For a similar reason, I could not easily converse with my peers. I sometimes felt extremely discouraged when I saw pure confusion on their faces as they could not grasp my true intention in my broken English phrases. Luckily, my school teachers and classmates were lenient with me and passionate about helping me out. Kai, however, was one of the first people who volunteered to help me with my English learning. He waited patiently for at least several seconds and threw me an encouraging look whenever I stumbled over words or failed to find the right English word or expression. He also played a crucial role in adjusting my English pronunciation and grammatical use in writing. Although Kai jokingly nicknamed my English speaking Morse code, since it was often hard for him to understand to the full extent, he was always welcoming and friendly whenever I needed help with English. Not surprisingly, my English ability soared like a rocket with the help of Kai, teachers, and many other students at school. I am grateful for their help and kindness. For the first time, I sensed a personal belonging to the school community. Not only did Kai help me with my basic English learning, he also invited me to stay with his family in San Francisco over the Christmas break. We tracked the landmark Hilly Roads, saw the Apple headquarters, and walked across the Golden Gate Bridge. He also introduced me to some of his friends, who greeted me with excitement and warmth. Kai's family also showed me superior hospitality. Kai's mom, Miss Nally, told me about the origins of Christmas and local traditions in San Francisco. She took me out to local restaurants to try Polish and Vietnamese food. Miss Nally always ensured me a safe and comfortable stay at their place. Throughout the trip with Kai in San Francisco, I felt cared for, loved, and valued, similar to how I would feel back in my original home with my parents in China. I am grateful that I met Kai at high school. It was a period of personal growth and friendship I could never have imagined before I started my academic journey in the US. His support in helping me with English and his passion for taking me to his hometown gave me a sense of belonging and joy when I needed help most. In return, I invited Kai to go to China with me over the spring break during our senior year at high school. I was proud to showcase my hometown, the city of Chongqing, which is the origin of a delicious meal called hot pot. Within the city, we witnessed the magnificent night view of the cityscape on the top of the highest local mountain, visited a Buddhist nunnery, and experienced the art of Chinese calligraphy at home. While Kai's stay in Chongqing was short, he was impressed by his engagement with the cultural and entertaining activities in Chongqing. His traveling widened his understanding of China and tightened the friendship bond between him and me. I'm sure my story with Kai will continue throughout our lifetime, as he is a true friend, a teacher, and a brother for another mother to me.
Now, you may be thinking, great story, but what on earth does this have to do with climate change? On the surface, nothing at all. Though as a metaphor, it touches on themes and feelings familiar to those of us doing climate work. Horace entered a new world and felt fear. He couldn't succeed alone, so he developed meaningful relationships as he navigated this new world. Now, let's listen to Erica's story. Again, pay attention to the details she includes and the feelings you experience listening to her story. After she's done, we'll unpack both stories to see the climate connections.
Throughout high school, I couldn't wait to graduate and move on to the next step, college. I was fortunate enough to have very supportive parents that encouraged higher education as a path for me and my siblings. When it came time to apply for schools, I had a friend that didn't know much about the process. I won't use her real name today for privacy purposes, so we'll call her Sophia. Picture this, we were high school seniors ready for this exciting next step. Sophia and I were close friends. We were on multiple sports teams together and shared classes, so we spent a lot of the day with each other. Sophia was outgoing, always bubbly and chatting away in our friend circle and during practices. Our senior year, we took time in our classes to learn about school options in California and how to apply for them. Sophia asked me questions like, how do I know what school I'm applying for? What's the California state system? And do we really need to pay for each application? I thought these questions seemed obvious. Hasn't she talked about this before? When she asked these questions aloud, people laughed and expected her to find the answers herself. I could tell she was very stressed out about the process. I mean, I was stressed too, because this was a very big step in our lives, but it came to a point where she stopped asking questions. She stopped talking to me about her applications. As deadlines approached, Sophia finally told me what was wrong. She was having trouble with school applications because although she was a citizen of the United States, her parents were undocumented. This prompted questions that I hadn't thought of before. What does this mean? What issues does this cause? I learned that this made it difficult to fill out general parent information, financial aid forms, and most importantly, her parents weren't able to support her because they just weren't familiar with college applications. I had just stepped into uncharted territory. At first, I thought, most of my friends are Hispanic, I'm Hispanic, we make up the majority of this school. Surely I can support my friend through this. Even surrounded by this community, a community where immigration is so common, I realized I had never had a conversation about it. I had never thought about someone so close to me dealing with these issues of immigration. And I had never been in a situation in which I tried to support them through it. Back in 2019, people didn't openly talk to others about their immigration status. There was a fear that didn't need to be verbalized. It's a fear that stopped my friend from seeking help, and a fear that even stopped me from talking to my parents about it. That day, I realized how ignorant I was to issues that I didn't face. Although I was surrounded by countless people who were probably going through something similar, I was never exposed to conversations about it. I did my best to support Sophia as a friend. I would answer the questions that I could, try to walk her through the application steps, and encourage her to seek advising. But I didn't understand the magnitude of the situation. Witnessing her stress made me ask, how many people are going through something similar?
Are you hearing any themes that remind you of your climate work? I heard the challenge of talking about a topic that many people want to avoid, a topic that is both personal and political. Like Horace, Erica was faced with something new, something she didn't know a lot about. The next step I had Erica and Horace take was to talk to each other about their stories. I asked them how they might pivot their stories to a climate-related issue or theme. Doing so will expand the types of climate change stories we tell. This goes beyond trying to convince others that climate change is real or serious. People need to hear all kinds of stories related to climate change because it is a multifaceted topic that intersects with so many other issues. Here is their conversation.
When talking about this problem that I had when I was younger, I had no idea that it would relate to issues about climate change. And the more I talked about it, the more I realized, wow, this has a lot of common themes. One of those themes is that climate change is, like immigration, such a silent topic. I mean, we're so scared to talk about climate change. This can relate to climate change because people without documentation are so fearful of talking about it that it just goes unsaid. And it's a very hushed topic, like climate change.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I do think that's a really solid point that people who do not have a legal documentation status in the United States, they will definitely feel more afraid of asking for help or asking for assistance from the government because they might fear the risk of getting deported, of getting exposed about their illegal status. This will be especially vulnerable for people who are undergoing climate crisis right now. You know, after severe flooding or forest fire events, people who are sharing this illegal status in the United States, they might be going through some obstacles that we could never, ever imagine.
Yeah, and I actually had, when I was younger, a couple experiences where I had to evacuate because of wildfires right in my backyard, basically. Talking about this story, I realized that Sophia probably would not have had the opportunity to evacuate and ask for help for people around her or from the government or from her insurance. I mean, there would just be so many issues that would come from being from parents that are undocumented and having family members that had that fear, and they wouldn't be able to ask for the same things that I was able to ask for.
Yeah. So speaking of fear, in my story, I'll also talk about the fear of being unfamiliar with a new environment, especially when I just arrived in the United States as a non-native English speaker. That fear, unlike the fear that you mentioned in the story, my fear of unfamiliarity also brings me that sense of anxiety and uncertainty about people or strangers that I've never met before. But I do think there's a common or shared element between these two different types of fear is that it drives people to be curious about the issue, especially for people who are observing this or for people who have already recognized this issue in society. And for people who are undergoing this kind of fear, anxiety and uncertainty would inspire them to talk about those issues to other people that they would trust. And this could be a good way for them to relieve their stress.
And there also is this fear of needing to know everything about a topic before you start talking about it or before you ask questions about it. And I see this a lot in the people around me when we talk about climate change. They think that because they're not experts, that they can't really ask questions or talk about it or have an opinion on it even. And we see this a lot in our personal stories. I mean, if we're not educated on a subject to the full capacity, you know, we feel like we can't really talk about it. But that's not the case. We should be encouraging each other to be curious, like you're saying, and ask questions and ask for help because we need the support in all these issues.
On top of that, just being able to open up and be able to seek for assistance, even though it could be much more difficult for people without the illegal documentation. But I do think there are organizations out there like CCL or Sierra Club, which are doing a great job in society to uncover those underrepresented communities in the United States and also just offering generous help to the more vulnerable communities, like the people you mentioned in your story. Furthermore, I think there's that benefit of getting to know new people just like me. When I first arrived at school, I wasn't expecting to make close friend like Kai. But you know, throughout the process, you might meet somebody that you strike a chord with that you just appreciate so much. Those people that you could meet on this new path to join the climate campaign could become your new friends. Not only you will learn a lot from them, but also those people will learn so many new things about you.
It's super important. I mean, you never know what other people are going through. And I think your story is super inspiring for being in a new place and being able to ask for that help.
So listeners, here are the ways that you can connect your personal stories to a climate issue or to a climate action. There are so many more examples that you can find in your daily life. And hopefully those personal stories would help you stay motivated in your climate work or just prompt you to make a further step on whatever that you would do to protect our environment and convince more people to join our sideline.
It's super important to find different ways to motivate ourselves through our climate work. And taking personal stories like this that may seem like hardships or obstacles to inspire us is definitely an important way to do this.
Yes, because there's always a way to find help, and there are always organizations or entities out there to offer you the help. Stay connected.
Horace and Erica, thank you so much for sharing your stories and making these connections for us. I'm in awe of the two of you. No, seriously, when you collaborated on this episode, you were physically very far apart from each other. So well done. You see, Horace is based in China and Erica is on the West Coast. What's that, a 15-hour time difference? Amazing. In a moment, I will tell you one more story and connect it to climate change. To summarize, though, we need a variety of climate change-related stories that cover the multitude of human experiences. Yes, we need stories that will help people take the threat of global warming seriously, but we also need stories that reveal the power of climate change solutions. We must share stories that unveil the driving force behind our efforts in addressing climate change. Stories that will inspire us to keep going. Stories that unearth how climate change affects some people differently than others. This takes hard work, imagination, and collaboration. Like Erica and Horace, find someone who will listen to your story and give you feedback so you can improve it. Workshop the story and tinker with it. Struggle to find the connections, and most likely you will. Here are three final points I want to impress upon you. Number one, when trying to make climate connections, not every story will work, and some will work better than others. Number two, some stories are too personal to share. Not all of our stories are meant for the general public. They may be too revealing or intimate to share. If you feel uncomfortable telling a personal story because it's too personal, respect that feeling. It may be the story you only share with a loved one. And number three, tell your own story, not someone else's. At first, Erica wasn't sure how to tell her story because it didn't feel like it was hers. It was about her friend. After the first draft, though, we gave her feedback to help her talk about her part of the story, her feelings, and the challenges she faced. If your story includes someone else, ask yourself, what is my part of the story to tell? That said, I'm about to break my own rule. I have a story a friend shared at a climate storytelling workshop I led. She is unavailable to tell it herself for this episode, but she said she would love for me to share it with her blessing, especially if it would help people better understand the concept of connecting personal stories to climate change. This is Tabitha's story. I share it with her consent. Tabitha grew up in Southern California, but then moved to Las Vegas, Nevada, and lived with her boyfriend. At first, things were going well. They both had a job and they enjoyed each other's company, but over time, the relationship got tense. The boyfriend became more and more demanding. In fact, Tabitha realized she was in the middle of an abusive relationship. Although he never physically harmed her, there was a lot of mental and emotional abuse. As her life became more and more enmeshed with the boyfriend, and she became more and more estranged from her own family in California, she decided she needed to move out. She needed to go back home to Southern California. But how? Her whole life was tangled up with this man. Their finances, their home, their friends. It would be starting all over from scratch. But one day, she had the courage to pack up a few things and take off while her boyfriend was at work. As she drove west with the mountains ahead of her, she began to immediately have doubts. This is too big of a change. How am I going to do something completely new? How am I going to make money? How is this going to work? She began to waver. And as she did, suddenly, there was an unexpected downpour of rain. It rained so hard, she had to pull over. It was in the midst of that rainstorm that she heard her own voice speaking to herself. Just keep going. just get over the mountain, then keep going. And she did. She got over that mountain. She got back to Southern California. Her family helped her put her life back together. And now she is married with a lovely man who respects her and her intellect and her creativity, and they have a beautiful son together. Now, what on earth does that have to do with climate change? I asked Tabitha. I was like, oh, wait, this is a beautiful story. It's powerful. It's personal. It's meaningful. But what does that have to do with climate change? Tabitha said, well, think about it. We are in this deep relationship with fossil fuels. It started out well as a society. Fossil fuels helped us and things seemed to be going well, but we became more and more dependent upon them. And over time, it's become a toxic relationship, quite literally, in that there are toxins in the air that are making us sick. She said, like, the relationship I was in, that toxic, abusive relationship, I needed to break free. We need to break free from our dependence on fossil fuels. But it's so hard because everything is entwined. You just can't walk away. It's in every aspect of our lives. But that's not an excuse to just sit in a toxic, abusive relationship. We need to keep going. We need to get over the hurdles that are ahead of us and keep going. I love that story. And I thank Tabitha for giving me permission to share it with you. Once we have fully crafted our stories and made connections to climate change, what do we do next? Well, share your story in every venue that makes sense. It could be on a Facebook page or as an op-ed in the newspaper. You might talk about it publicly at an Earth Day event or Toastmasters. You can share it with a friend over lunch. You can share it with fellow climate advocates to inspire them and deepen their understanding. I would love to hear one of your personal stories and how you connected to climate change. You may have a story and you do not yet see the connection to climate change. It would be great to share this story with the audience, and we can see what connections they make. Feel free to email me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also call our listener voicemail, 619-512-9646. I will repeat these contact details at the end of the show, or just visit cclusa.org/radio.
That's what we have room for today on Spirit in Action from our friends at Citizens Climate Radio. We've got their links to CCR and to their guests on northernspiritradio.org. Please remember to check out my deep dive interview with Peterson Toscano from July 2024 on our site, and maybe the interview I did with him back in 2007. And you can look forward to more of the fine fruits of Citizens Climate Radio program here on Spirit in Action again in 3 months. I'm so thankful for their work, and I ask that you help me uplift their message by sharing it with others you know. Together, we can do amazing things. Enrich your life and heal the world, and we'll see you next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.